Lindsay certainly was very gripped by the dream experiences we, Peter and I, had been sharing. How did I come by this knowledge? By logical deduction, reasoning, insight? Actually, because there she was again, sitting in the living room, eagerly anticipating further real-side experiences. She had arrived even before we had, possibly to declare war on our custard cream biscuit tin, but I would give her the benefit of the doubt, and determine her early appearance to be due to enthusiasm. We all were seated. All unnecessary technological distractions were extinguished. The time required for the dogs to settle after our return was granted, and Peter was even wearing his most colourful tie to mark the occasion. The design on it was so convoluted, there seemed to be no scientific explanation for its complexity. But then, science was very literally, physically, one-dimensional, and so we couldn't be relying on something so limited to unveil the secret of Peter's clothing. I would start the ball rolling, and roll it would, trundling through all manner of worlds, life levels, and situations. So then, I would find myself on a street. Nothing especially out of the ordinary. The only thing that drew my attention was a solitary car. So, curiously, I approached the vehicle and would discover its occupant to be Gwen. Naturally, I approached and engaged her in conversational dialogue. She seemed to be somewhat melancholy and disheartened. I inquired as to the reason for her being in such a state of being. She would respond how she was, in fact, incredibly bored in this dream, that she didn't understand why it was as limiting here as it is on the physical. I took it upon myself to disprove her contentions of believed limitations. The car, in fact, represented an attitude, the one she was currently demonstrating. I bent down, gripping the edge of the car, and proceeded to raise it above my head with evident ease, and still with its startled occupant inside of it, peering down at me from the window, and from her now far more elevated position. This impressed upon her the fact that, beyond the physical, things in fact were manipulated by thought and imagination, the only limit being that which one decides, and her previous state of sadness dissipated with the dispelling of her prior belief of self-imposed limitation. I returned the car to the ground. Out Gwen would exit and accompanied me. As I was adamant about proving still further the thoroughly unrestrictive nature of our position here on this life level, I led her to a house and intended that we enter, but going through the door in the traditional manner would be rather mundane, and besides, I wanted to continue with my environment-manipulating demonstration. I extended my arms to many times their usual length. Certainly would be useful on the physical for those always just out of reach remote controllers, and I seized the edges of the building. Again, with absolute ease, I ripped the entire front section of the house clean away, as though it were a papier-mâché doll's house, and in we went. The occupants of the house didn't seem too perturbed at our presence, or the means by which we chose to enter their abode. In fact, they were in the process of making their dinner. Although perhaps slightly imposing, we did linger momentarily. Suddenly, another individual entered the scene and didn't seem to share his associate's calm disregard. In fact, he attempted to assail me, lunging at me with fists a-flailing. His assault seemed ineffective, rather laughable, but nevertheless we have the right to defend ourselves, despite how feeble the attack may be. I seized the antagonistic individual by the material of his collar and propelled him skywards. Well, it would have been skyward had the ceiling not been there to meet his head. The ceiling made contact with his head, which proceeded to smash right through it. That it was no longer visible, and he was rendered unconscious. Then the dream would end. Lindsay found that rather amusing, even more so as I explained how the final scene was a little like that in Superman 2 with Christopher Reeve, where Zod, one of the evil superfolks, did this very thing to the chief reporter. On that occasion, Zod was the antagonist, and so he was not defending himself. But I found it an acceptable and amusing thing to do given the circumstances. So the entire dream was a demonstration. The guides do them all the time, and they also encourage and prompt us to do likewise, to where we have our adventures and incorporate other individuals into it, if it is acceptable to them, and Gwen evidently found this acceptable. Lindsay wanted to know more of what the house part meant. I would respond that the house represents the personal self on the real side, and so here we had individuals inside it, within their personal self, their mind and senses, etc. So it's likely the house was an individual I knew. In a way, I intruded on their personal self. I ripped the front of the house off and entered. And evidently, someone didn't like what I was doing. We have all these abilities on the real side, but we certainly can get ourselves into spots of bother by utilising them. So yes, I just barged in on this individual. They were in the midst of dinner, having their private life, and somebody wasn't amused. Lindsay remarked how she was hoping I wouldn't start trying to enter her home in a similarly unsociable manner. I assured her I would not, at least not when she was in the middle of making the dinner, at any rate. I would continue with another real side experience. In this dream, I was in an observing capacity, neither immersed in the dream with a role to play, nor did I interact with any of the dream participants or the scenery. So it's safe to assume then all houses would be safe from my particular brand of entry. I was objectively viewing then from a place of awareness. So I would behold a village. The era was difficult to determine, but despite the simple nature of the structures, I would suggest it was in modern times. The exact location and even dimension I could not say, but the inhabitants were human. One of the inhabitants was engrossed in a peculiar ceremony. She was burying the dead, but in a way unfamiliar to my knowledge. The female was electing to bury the remains, but in such a manner that they face a particular direction. This seemed to be of utmost importance and essential to the customs of her people. Just another ritual, then, as many seem to indulge in, and the fact that she was burying bones clearly was demonstrating that what she was doing was an old idea that was dead. Her curious ritual was complete, but no sooner had she finished that she received a surprising and unexpected guest. A reptilian burst from the ground, or at least would appear to do so. A walking, talking lizard man, possessing of grey-green scaled skin, and a monstrous attitude to match. He bundled the shocked female unceremoniously to the ground, and held her fast. Clearly something had gotten under his scaled skin, and the recipient of his wrath was the hapless female. He would reveal to the wide-eyed female the reason for his aggression. He explained how the reptilians were disgruntled at the human people due to the strange rituals they indulged in. It seemed that what the humans were doing was affecting the reptilians in a way that had the scaled creatures most displeased. Judging by her shocked reaction, she and her people were clearly blissfully unaware that reptilians even existed. So evidently, this was the first time one of the reptilians had revealed themselves to any of them. Also unaware of how, apparently, their human rituals were adversely affecting this never-before-encountered species. The reptilian would promptly vanish, but not before he assured the female that severe ramifications would be the result of her and her people's reptilian irritating transgressions. Seems the reptilian was not making idle threats, as later the village suffered an attack from an invisible menace, and many of the people were slaughtered. However, there were a scattered spate of witness sightings of the reptilian perpetrators, so either not all were invisible, or some of the humans were, for whatever reason, able to see the administrators of this carnage. The next day, normality resumed, as normal as it is possible after such an event. Still objectively viewing, and although the dream was of a short duration, my observing spanned many months of their time. Curiously, despite the reptilians clearly being responsible for the deaths of these people, many elected to take up a kind of worship of them, some of them even dressing up in crude costumes that loosely resembled their assailants of months ago. As they persisted with their reptilian idolizing and costume wearing, actual reptilians would consistently move among them unseen. I can only speculate, but assume the reptilians were always there, just up until now had chosen to remain concealed, but all along doing what reptilians do, inserting tap lines and usurping energy, energy vampirizing. Lindsay inquired as to what the reptilians' problem was initially, or were they just naturally grumpy and always looking for a reason to cause problems and rough up weaker genders and indeed species. If reptilians did like abusing females, they obviously hadn't met many that lived around these parts. In my town, the older females could be devastating with their handbags and frying pans. It would take a brave reptilian to antagonize them. I suggested that maybe the reptilians' concerns were legitimate, that due to the collective focus on ritualistic ideas, the humans may have been creating astral thought forms or projections. And being astral as much as physical, the reptilians may well have had continuous and unwelcome interactions with these astral manifestations. Maybe ghosts of the human dead were causing disruption. If the rituals were of a kind that caused the individuals to become stuck in this manner. If the beliefs were along the lines that there was nothing beyond death, and this was decided and agreed to, then those passing on would not go to the next position, but may well find themselves between positions, confused and disruptive. It seems, too, that despite the attack by these reptilians, the reason why they chose to then worship or deify them may be because they believed them to possibly be gods or demons or something of this nature from a higher realm or expression of existence. I suggested then that if the reptilians had maybe once revealed themselves to these people at some stage long ago in their history, as they have done with humans, and perhaps masqueraded as gods, then it may have triggered an ancestral collective memory of this that had the attached reaction, that of a kind of worship of them, that was therefore triggered. Even though the knowledge would not be in living memory or even recorded, it would nevertheless be stored in each individual's causal body, which was a storehouse of every experience an individual has ever had since they first entered creation. And the corresponding triggered reaction may well be that of worship and reverence. I pondered as to how humans might react should a similar occurrence unfold. If the reptilians revealed themselves, would we all be wearing silly lizard outfits too? Lindsay was quick to then point out that I always seem to be around and in situations where someone is being bothered or annoyed by something or someone. I responded and informed her that, like everyone in creation, the lizards are bored too. They might find it a novelty to watch the humans with their little routines, but after a while it probably becomes tiresome. The reptilians are not only bored, but they like to engage antagonistically, so they will use any excuse to do so, and these rituals are as good an excuse as any. They probably regard the humans as stupid monkeys doing stupid things. I watched as Gwen spilled a little of her cup of tea over herself. Perhaps I could appreciate the reptilians' perspective view at times in regards to humans. They must watch on with amusement as humans shuffle around like zombies, staring at their mobile phones, falling down potholes and walking into lampposts. Interestingly, the physical part, the personal self, would regard all the silly things it does as normal, all the rituals and nonsense, but not see what it truly was, as it would be revealed on the real side. And these ceremonies, these ideas in creation, can go on for eternity. Lindsay wanted to know more about the reptilians. The extent to which they follow people about and tapline them. I mentioned then the Ekankar seminars, and how Sandy, a new friend who had the ability to see these astral lurking reptilians, had seen them swarming all over, underneath, and around the oblivious Ekankar members. This is the reality of these ideas. The Pope, the Dalai Lama, all these things and people, on the surface they look fine, just like the Ek seminar. But on the real side, it's something quite different. If the guides were backing them and the focus was on these, it wouldn't be so. But it's focused on ritualistic stuff that draws in and attracts these things that are dead. Death attracts death, regardless of how fine the thoughts and sayings are, the scriptures, etc. It's all about the intent. People go along with the ideas, which become ritualism and ceremony. These cute ideas that are created that seem to substantiate something, like belief, hope, and faith. They are nothing, but are supposedly something. So people perform their reality, but what you see on the real side is the actuality of what people are performing, which equals nothing. Lindsay was clearly not very taken with the reptilians. It was true, they were a difficult species to paint in a positive light, with exceptions, I am sure. Every species has its heroes and vagabonds, but seemed the reptilians were quite comfortable assuming the role and position of villains of the universe. And in fact, beyond the creational physical universe too. Maybe one day we could all sit around a table, reptilians and humans alike, and share a joke and a meal, assuming the humans didn't end up being the meal. Perhaps we would be wise to only invite reptilians into our midst, who were of a size and appetite that we wouldn't be a viable menu addition. You're not squeamish about rats, are you? I inquired of my sister. She was a little confused as to the random nature of such a question. She would assure me that she was not. The only thing of the earth that she couldn't abide were worms. The reason for my query was due to my about to share a dream that involved a rat. A very large rat. A rat considerably larger than someone who was deftly fearful of them would care to hear about. But then, was an animal-based phobia dependent on its size? Content in the knowledge that Lindsay wouldn't hastily vacate the house, with assurances that no worms featured in the dream I was about to recount either, I would begin. This experience I would describe as an attack by the dark forces. An experience because it incorporated both the real side dream arena and the waking physical level. I was in flux between sleep and wakefulness, moving back and forth between the two states of being as the events would unfold. Initially, in a dream, I would find myself under a relentless attack from all kinds of insects, flying ones, scuttling ones, crawling ones, indescribable ones, and all in vast quantities, swarms of them washing over me, and fear not, no worms were there, as far as I could tell, under the tidal wave of insects. Emerging from sleep allowed me to escape my insectoid assailants, but my torments, it seemed, would continue on the physical level. Despite being fully awake, I was agitated further by an invisible menace. I was prodded and poked, my bedclothes thrown askew and into disarray, my pillows tossed haphazardly about, yanked fiercely from beneath my head. Amazingly, I found myself slipping back into sleep. You'd have thought that such an assault would not be especially conducive for sleep, and yet back into the dream I went. The insects were laying in wait for me, and their attack resumed with renewed vigour. Back and forth I went, between the dream and the swarming insects, and waking to the invisible bed-rearranging assailants. There seemed to be no way out of my predicament, nowhere to hide, no safe haven, but help would come in a most unexpected, but certainly welcome form. While back in the dream, and with every insect in the world buzzing, biting, and crawling over me, a large rat would enter the room I was in. I assumed this rat was about to join in the attack. It was far larger than a standard rat. Hard though it was to glean an estimate, due to my insect-related plight, I'd say about the size of a medium dog. My first impressions from the rodent were not those of malevolence directed at my insect-covered self, and in fact all the insects immediately ceased their attack. As the rodent approached, they withdrew, scuttling, crawling, and retreating by whatever insect means they had at their disposal. The rat then elected to sit on my chest. Just as well it wasn't the size of a bear then, and seemed to be guarding me. My safety was assured, for no insects would come near, as long as my new guardian rodent remained. I tentatively stroked it, conscious that it could very easily do me harm, and while I did so, a curious thing did occur. Its fur changed colour, and continued to change colour, switching through every conceivable colour imaginable. It surely was the most colourful rodent in history. Suddenly, my parents, Gwen and Peter, burst in, a little dumbfounded at first, and not surprisingly, considering the huge rainbow rodent in their midst. After collecting themselves, they would inform me of how they had suffered an attack, not dissimilar to mine. Curiously, their attack had ceased suddenly, and it would seem due to the presence of this animal guardian. Then I would awake, and was equally as relieved that the tormentors on the physical level were also nowhere to be seen. Maybe the rat's influence had spread to even the physical life level. There must be more to this rodent than met the eye. Lindsay remarked how I ought to keep my room tidier if it's going to start attracting rats, as beneficial as this particular rat may have been. I suggested the possibility that this rat was perhaps an old friend, maybe an old pet, even from a lifetime long distant, that noticed my plight and came to render assistance. All animals have counterparts on all life levels too, including the real universes, and were one to encounter a rat on a higher life level, higher for the literal self anyway, one might expect to be in the presence of a far wiser and aware version of the rat than on the physical level. One more inclined to offer aid, as in this case, rather than just bite me and pee on my foot. Being in greater states of awareness also is more likely to have us receive assistance and even advice and communication from animals, if we connect with them from a place of real awareness, being to being. It could have been a shape-shifting individual who decided the form of a rat was the most suitable one under the circumstances, maybe even a guide. As guides can and will alter their forms when situations dictate. In New Book One, Dwayne recounted how he was saved from a pack of wolves in a similar manner, Reba's Artars becoming an eagle in that example. Lindsay remarked how she'd rather be saved by something more exciting, like a lion, or maybe a dinosaur. I impressed upon her how smart rats actually were, how they were great survivors, and besides, this one had multicolour fur, so was good from an entertainment perspective alone. But it was again a reminder, a warning. My parents and I had evidently drawn the attention of the dark forces, and agitated them to the point where attacks were to be expected. But far better to be on with our adventures than pretend everything is fine, and in fact be sucked down on a daily basis into the forbidding mire that is creation. Now, more than ever, it is time to really focus, pay attention, and really see through it all, to be okay with it and get through creation. There is so much unconscious agreement within the personal self, and yes, it is an individual's right to agree with whatever they choose. But for those wanting to get through it all, each person must decide how to go about it. Lindsay still insisted on having a dinosaur as a protector. She wasn't going to waver on that. I didn't point out the obvious flaws in her request, the limited dimensions of the room I was in at the time, and that of a dinosaur entering it, and that a dinosaur may well be in fact representing a reptilian, so probably more inclined to join in the attack rather than defend someone from it. Knowing Lindsay's predisposition for all movies of a mythological nature, I elected to regale her with a dream incorporating dragons and castles. This would expand her awareness to the reality of these creatures and settings actually existing in places in creation. There was a huge castle in the sky. A strange place to keep it, I suppose, for there it floated, seemingly in opposition and defiance of the laws of gravity. and it was the home of several large dragons. They lorded over the castle, or ladied over it, I suppose, considering they were female. Exactly as you would imagine a dragon to look, just like those you might see in the Game of Thrones series. Only these would certainly take exception to someone clambering on their backs and attempting to fly them. They resided in the uppermost turrets. I would find myself with a considerably larger group than usual in the lower section of the castle. The entire thing was set up as a kind of test, various stages to be bypassed, and if successfully navigated, we would have a final confrontation with the dragons. The first test was an ordeal of a kind, which involved fire and the avoiding of it. Pillars of fire would blast in our direction, and we established, after a while, that there was a sequence, and thus the fire could be predicted as to where it would strike. This formed then the nature of the first test, to survive the fire blasting until this particular part of the initial trial ended. What would then follow would be a collection of smaller lizard and dragon-like creatures that my group and I had to slay. And after evading fire, slaying this group of lizards, we would have an encounter with a final monster, and if we proved our worth and eliminated it, we would move further into the castle. It had the feel of a computer game in this regard. And when victory was secured, even a treasure chest would appear, and the contents made available. The fire pillars had a sequence that I had a dim recollection of, as though I'd done this on some prior occasion. But alas, my memory failed me, and we had to proceed through trial and error. A few of our number were engulfed and burned to their deaths. As we made more errors than not in our trial and error approach, very vivid too, a fate I wouldn't wish bestowed on anyone. Curiously, one of our number had the ability to withstand fire, which certainly was a useful skill to have under the circumstances, but this ability would only activate at a certain point, and we were uncertain as to exactly when. As you can imagine, this had him somewhat concerned and exasperated, as we were unable to yield this information. Out of our number, only one did I recognise, and this was a new friend named Kelsey, and she was orchestrating our strategy. Frustratingly, I never saw the culmination of this test, if indeed we were met with success or failure, as I would wake up. Lindsay was very captivated. It seemed I was going about my process of waking up by going through situations that were very adventurous and fun. If being blasted at by fire and fighting dragons fit your category of a fun time, I, like many, are given such opportunities to see what we will do. There are many steps to waking up, recognizing and handling that recognition. Lindsay was wondering if I ever would return to the castle and complete further tests and engage the dragons in mighty combat, as they seem to represent the final test. I assured her that given the opportunity, I would do just that. I even asked if she would accompany me, if ever the chance was presented to her. Only if she had access to the individual in the dream's magical fire-resistant capabilities, was her response. My real side recounting was complete for another day. Peter was eager to share. Lindsay was veritably bouncing up and down with eager anticipation. And so Peter had the floor, and into his real side dreams we would be taken, perchance, of more adventures, glimpses into other worlds and dimensions, and defiance to the controllers and the Callum God as he went about it.
Lindsay looked at me and asked me if I had had any other interesting dreams recently, to which I answered, nothing as exciting as Kevin's, but only the other night I had one interesting one. I seemed to be in a large room which contained only, as far as I could see, an elderly man in a single bed. I appeared to be in a hospital. Evidently, I had come to visit him. There was nobody else in sight. It appeared, in fact, that nobody came to visit him except me, and I had apparently visited him regularly for some time, so much so that it was beginning to take its toll on my working. This was all the more odd, as I didn't know who on earth he was, but just felt sorry for him. Then a young woman appeared. I assumed at first she was his daughter, but apparently this was not the case. She appeared on several subsequent visits, but I did not find out who she was. Coming out of the room one evening, we were going down a wide corridor together in total darkness, when a young man in dark clothing with a hood, although it didn't cover his face, jumped out of the darkness in front of me and said, "Boo," or something equally inane, and was taken aback when he received an earful of unprintable abuse back from me. He seemed quite downhearted as he withdrew into the shadows and disappeared. I wish I hadn't been quite so rude, but he had made me jump. It now appeared that the old man had passed on, and for some reason the young woman, who it now transpired was a schoolteacher, wanted me to come to some kind of meeting at her school one day at 10 a.m. Accordingly, I found myself driving to the school in what I now knew was Luton, the large town I had been born and raised in, some 14 to 15 miles away from where we now live. I know most of Luton pretty well. I had lived there until I was 27, when I got married. Yet in the dream, I suddenly seemed lost, or at least could not remember the way to the street where the school was. Oddly, the large main road I was driving down was deserted, in fact, totally devoid of any vehicles, human or mechanical, moving or stationary. I noticed the road and the pavements, sidewalks, were turning white with a fine layer of powdery snow. I was driving my present car, which I have only had for some 11 months, so it appeared to be in the present time. Suddenly I could see the woman in a large, sunny, well-lit room with her apparent mistress sitting either side of a large desk. I was still driving. It was now 10 a.m. and I apologised for the fact I was going to be late and mentioned in passing the snow. Neither of us appeared to have telephones, cameras or any other device that could explain how we managed to see each other or converse in this manner. A voice, possibly the headmistress's, said, "What snow? It's not snowing here at all." In the meantime, the teacher had stood up and left the room, saying there was no point in waiting here and she would be back later. That was basically the end of the dream. "So what did it all mean?" Lindsay then asked. "Well," I began, "I did mull it over and put some suggestions to Dwayne. He agreed my suspicion that the teacher was very likely one of the real guides. I had not realised it, but falling snow apparently is a metaphor for the real side, and The fact that nobody else in the dream could see it, although the guide obviously could, was confirmation that I was on a different wavelength to others, hence presumably also the deserted street. I mentioned in my summing up to Duane that I had once, perhaps 25 or more years ago, been told by a self-styled clairvoyant that he was getting the message that this life was my last chance to get it right. At the time, I had mentally brushed it aside, but in the light of what is happening now in the world and the apparent narrow time slot to take on the new you, maybe he had been right. Duane said he knew there were many clairvoyants and similar who had genuine knowledge and who got it up to a point, but only up to a point. I also mentioned that I wondered if the guide was indicating to me that I needed to pull my socks up and maybe they were getting tired of waiting for me to. I felt I had lived for thousands of years on Earth, so I had past life sessions going back to as far as ancient Babylon 2,000 to 3,000 years ago and felt extremely world weary. Duane did not come back on this, but I guess he felt that was for me to decide. What other dreams have you had recently? Lindsay then asked me. How long have you got? I responded. As long as it takes. Oh well, here's another really creepy one, I said. I seemed again to be in either a hospital or doctor's surgery in a large kind of reception area. I was standing a few yards away, facing a lady doctor or maybe pharmacist. She suddenly kicked a pillbox-like object across the floor to me. For some reason, I sensed great guilt or evil about the thing. I could practically hear a Wagnerian death motive in my mind. With a sardonic laugh, I kicked it back to her. I wasn't having any of it. The scene changed, although it seemed to be part of the same dream. I was watching two men talking. Nothing odd about that, you might think, except that the man to my left had two heads. Both of them horses' heads. The normal man, who I could not properly see as my attention was perhaps understandably focused on the horsey chap, was asking the left head of the latter if he would murder somebody for him. To this the reply came, "What's in it for me, except the electric chair?" "No, no," said the other man, "they wouldn't do that. It would kill your innocent brother as well." All through the proceedings, the right head seemed to be asleep or unconscious, totally out of it. Evidently there was enough in it for him for left head to take on the contract. Confident he wouldn't ride the lightning or fry, as they say in all the gangster movies. Evidently, however, things had gone wrong as the scene changed and I found myself reading some apparently American law book which said, if the prescribed method of execution cannot be used, then an alternative may be. The final scene had us entering the execution chamber, but instead of an electric chair, there stood a guillotine. Evidently, it was thought that somehow taking off the guilty head would spare the innocent or uninterested one. That's where it ended. Duane said the first scene, kicking the pillbox, if such it was, referred to the physical body. The foot is a symbol for this, and the pillbox object symbolised drugs, which I was clearly rejecting. That rings true. I would have to be in extreme agony before I'd take even a painkiller. And never take other pills for anything, never mind the kind of drugs Duane was clearly describing. Regarding the second part of the dream, Duane said the two heads symbolised the dual aspect and the lack of focus. He strongly felt a political flavour to the whole thing and mentioned the fact that the symbols of the two main American political parties are a donkey and an elephant. I thought then in Britain they're all donkeys, and was reminded that in the First World War the Germans referred to the British soldiers as lions led by donkeys. Myself thinking further about this dream, I wondered if the two heads symbolised also the two sides of the brain, in this case an evil, corrupt, pragmatic left side, evidently the boss, over the more sensitive, spiritual, if that's the right word, and in this case looking the other way, right side. I suspect a dilemma I have faced in more than one past life. What's a guillotine? Lindsay then asked. It's a machine for beheading people, I answered. Well, lovely. I once had a very vivid dream I was guillotined, I mentioned. But that's for another day. Anyone want another cup of tea?